This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the greatest heroes of World War II. He was an architect, a businessman, a Swedish diplomat, and a humanitarian. He managed to save as many as 100,000 Hungarian Jews from the Nazi Holocaust. And for his courageous actions, he was seized by the Soviets, taken to a notorious prison in Moscow, and then basically never seen nor heard from again. Chances are good you have heard the astounding story of Raoul Wallenberg, but perhaps you didn't know that this world-acclaimed Swedish humanitarian has a Michigan chapter to his remarkable life. In the early 1930s, he studied architecture at the University of Michigan and lived a student's life in Ann Arbor. To honor the 100th anniversary of Raoul Wallenberg's birth, the university has joined with the Swedish Consulate General of Detroit and designed an exhibition to tell his story and present the choices that made him a hero to so many. The exhibition is called To Me, There Is No Other Choice. And as part of the opening, the university has brought in Swedish journalist Ingrid Carlberg. Her award-winning biography of Wallenberg won the 2012 August Prize for the best Swedish nonfiction book, and it's now being translated into English for publication into the U.S. eventually. Its title, There Is a Room Waiting for You Here, The Story of Raoul Wallenberg. And Ingrid Carlberg joins us here in the studio. It's very good to have you with us, Ingrid.
And it's so nice to be here.
You know, the story of Raoul Wallenberg echoes the perhaps better-known story of Oskar Schindler in that both men were clever, they were both resourceful and brave, and they found a way to save Jews from the Holocaust and from the Nazis. Now, Steven Spielberg's movie introduced the world to Oskar Schindler. But for those not as familiar with Raoul Wallenberg's story, describe to us how he came to be in a position during the war to make such a difference and save so many lives.
Actually, it was some kind of a coincidence, you could say. Mm-hmm. Normally, people believe that Raoul Wallenberg was a career diplomat in Sweden. Mm-hmm. He was not. He was not. A businessman. He was doing business with, he was importing, in fact, groceries from Hungary in an import-export firm, Swedish-Hungarian import-export firm situated in Stockholm. His co-worker, Kalman Lauer, came from Hungary. So you could say when the Germans marched into Hungary in the spring of 1944, of course, Raoul Wallenberg at a very early stage was alarmed about what was going on. Mm-hmm. But actually the mission to go to Budapest and to lead a rescue mission, the initiative to that mission came from the American government, mm-hmm. not the Swedish government.
Because word was getting out about the atrocities happening to Jews.
And in the late stage of the war, mm-hmm. the American government founded this War Refugee Board mm-hmm. just to try to save what was left was, of European Jewry. And the Americans, they couldn't act themselves in a place in Hungary because they were part of the war.
That's right.
So they tried to make neutral states to send some extra diplomats to Budapest to administer such a rescue mission.
So Sweden was perfect.
Sweden was perfect, but the name Raoul Wallenberg, mm-hmm. you could believe, and I think even most Swedes believe, that it was the Swedish government who chose the name Raoul Wallenberg for this mission. Hmm. It was not. It was the American minister of Stockholm, because the import-export firm where Raoul Wallenberg worked was situated in the same building as the American embassy. So there he had his young candidate, mm-hmm. the American minister, and he suggested it too. So that's how he came to be suddenly.
So this was
in Budapest.
They saw this. Raoul is a sharp, bright young man, but I have to imagine that they sensed a sense of caring that he would take this on, saving the Jews of Budapest would be a mission to him.
Yeah, he was to be a Swede in the 30s. Mm-hmm. He was very cosmopolitan in his way of living. He had been living three and a half years in Ann Arbor to start with, which gave him a totally another perspective on things going on than most Swedes did. Mm-hmm. He was kind of a pioneer when it came to studying in the United States. They also saw the fact, of course, that he had been traveling a lot in Hungary. So he had his own network in Budapest. He had been in Budapest at least three times during the war. So it was natural for the Americans to ask him. He would be the perfect person, and he had no family. He could leave.
Yes, so off he goes. Raoul Wallenberg goes to Budapest, and the mission is save as many Jews as you can from the Germans and from the Nazis and the Arrow Crossers. Who are the Arrow Crossers?
7 weeks before he came to Budapest, you could see the largest mass deportations of Hungarian of Jews during the whole World War II. Over 400,000 Jews were deported to Auschwitz. But when he came, suddenly the Hungarian regent Miklos Horthy had managed to stop the deportations for a while. Mm-hmm. So they managed to halt the deportations up until the 15th of October 1944, when the Hungarian Nazis, the Arrow Crossers, were put in power in Hungary. There was a coup led by the Germans. So Hitler managed to have his own Nazi party in Hungary.
And then all bets were off.
Then it became really rough.
So what was the method that the Swedish government and Raoul Wallenberg worked out to be able to, how did they save these people?
It's a combination. When it comes to Raoul Wallenberg, it's a combination of individual courage that he had really shown during the Arrow Cross terror mm-hmm. in the last month of mm-hmm. 1944. Then he was, I would say, there were a lot of neutral diplomats present in Budapest, but they all hid it mm-hmm. in the end of 1944. Raoul Wallenberg was the only one still in the streets doing his rescue actions. But as I see it, having digged into mm-hmm. this rescue mission a lot, his greatest achievement in Budapest was the organization that he built up in order to be able to rescue people. For this, he was financed by the Americans. Mm-hmm. So he had the task to do a very big rescue mission.
Mm-hmm. Not just a few people.
He had 350 people employed, mostly Jews who volunteered, who was protected by Swedish protective papers.
And that
so
was
that
the key,
organization
wasn't it?
Is a key. It is a heart mm-hmm. in the whole rescue mission in Budapest that autumn.
So you mentioned the Swedish protective papers.
Yeah.
Was that the key? So he had his organization in place. What would he do then in order to secure a Jewish family or a Jewish person and keep them safe? What was the key?
The key was these protective papers. He designated a special Schutzpass called mm-hmm. Swedish Schutzpass, which was just a fake protective paper, but it looked really good, like a normal real passport with photos and stamps and everything.
And the Germans like that.
And
they,
the Germans,
that spoke
yes,
to
there
them.
Were a lot of fake papers, but mm-hmm. the one the artistic Raoul Wallenberg designated or created mm-hmm. was the most credible one. And this Swedish protective paper, the Schutzpass, was distributed to Hungarian Jews with Swedish connections. You could say that in the beginning of this autumn, he only distributed those protective Schutzpasses to Hungarian Jews who could really show close Swedish connections. But in the end, it
yes.
didn't matter. When the murders didn't follow any rules, he decided not to follow any rules either.
and ultimately, he's credited with saving up to 100,000 lives, which is stunning. But what is...
It depends how you define
sure.
rescuing. I would put it a bit lower,
a little
actually,
bit, but yeah. nonetheless, when you think
nonetheless,
of...
we are talking thousands and tens of thousands.
And for that work, it boggles the mind that the ultimate result was when the Soviets rolled into Budapest, not that he was hailed as a hero, he was arrested.
Yes.
Talk to us about what happened in January of 45.
I would say that among the Swedish diplomats mm-hmm. in Budapest, everyone agreed with Raoul Wallenberg, had the same opinion or same view on the arrival of the Soviet troops, that this was the liberation. Soviet and United States were on the same
That's
side
right.
in the war. Raoul Wallenberg had an American mission.
Yeah.
This would be terrific. So what he did was that he decided to voluntarily cross the border, or the front, you could say, mm-hmm. the border, the mm-hmm. front, to meet the Soviet army and suggest a collaboration in when it came to rescuing the ghetto
yes.
in Budapest, and as well as rebuilding Hungary after the war. But and he didn't have any other view than that the Soviets would applaud him. for the rescue action, but they didn't. They found him suspicious.
Why? Suspicious of espionage?
Yeah. Because at that part of the war, the Soviet Union and United States were still on the same side of the war, but they were suspicious
of each other.
Yeah, especially Stalin was very suspicious on Roosevelt and United States or the Western allies as a whole, because he thought he was convinced that they were going behind his back and dealing with the peace negotiations with Germany all on his own. And to be American, have an American job, if you could say
yes.
So, that Raoul Wallenberg had. Part of his job was an American mission. Part of it was a Swedish mission. Although it was secret, the American role in it was secret in a way, but the Soviets knew it. So they were very, very suspicious. And there were other reasons too.
Yes.
He was so creative. Raoul Wallenberg, in his work, he could meet with the devil if that could save another life. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot of Nazi contacts in his telephone book. So I think they imagined him being a double spy.
Okay.
Double spy, you say so?
Yes, double agent.
Double agent.
So yes. Off he was taken off to the notorious prison in Moscow where the KGB had its headquarters ultimately.
Yeah, Lubyanka.
And basically never heard from again.
Basically never heard from again. But we know since the beginning of the 90s, when the Russians started in a short period of openness.
After the Soviet Union collapses.
Yes, yes, exactly. After the perestroika, mm-hmm. a lot of documents were published where you could follow Raoul Wallenberg in prison the first 2.5 years. So afterwards, we know that he was alive at least until July 1947. So 2.5 years he was in
yes.
the two Moscow prisons.
And then, as I was reading the preliminary translation of your book, I get the sense as the Russians and the Soviets and then the Russians were asked, what happened? You got different stories. You got, he had a heart attack. He was executed. No, he had a heart attack. So, Ingrid Carlberg, what is your very best guess as far as what did happen to this man?
I don't, the official Russian version today, 2012, is still the same as the one left that was given to the Swedish government in 57.
Which was?
That Raoul Wallenberg died a natural death in heart attack the 17th of July, 1947. I don't believe that he died a natural death.
You don't believe it?
No. But I think that he was executed in the neighborhood of that date. That's the most credible thing, but we don't know. We cannot exclude the possibility that Raoul Wallenberg was alive for several years after 1947, since there are no credible proof of his death.
The mind demands a happier ending than that.
He demanded a Raoul Wallenberg to save his life, but there were no Raoul Wallenberg for Raoul Wallenberg.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and with me today in the studio is Swedish journalist Ingrid Carlberg, her award-winning biography of Raoul Wallenberg. We're discussing that book and the new exhibition celebrating the life of Raoul Wallenberg, opening at the University of Michigan. That exhibition, to me, there's no other choice. Talk to us, if you will, about his years in Ann Arbor. And I know it was his grandfather who felt that he needed to go someplace where there weren't a lot of distractions and get a good education.
Yes.
And so instead of Europe or perhaps the East Coast of the United States, he planted his grandson right in the heart of the Midwest in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Did Raoul enjoy his time in Michigan?
To be honest, not in the beginning. Mm-hmm. He didn't find this. He was so surprised. His grandfather had told him that he has to go to United States to inhale this American spirit, this self-consciousness and everything. And he was, I think he had the picture of those skyscraper, the towns with a lot of skyscrapers,
Chicago, the modern New York City.
United States. And he dumped here. He was dumped in Ann Arbor and looked around and they found small houses and a town where everybody talked about Europe. They were more interested to ask him about Europe than to give him an American spirit. So in the beginning, he was rather bored, I think. Mm-hmm. But that changed quite quickly.
Yes.
So he found it hard to leave after 3.5 years.
What caught him? What was it, his studies? Was it his classmates?
His classmates. He had a lot of friends. I do also think that he was actually quite praised during his studies. He got good grades. And they found him, I think, both when it came to art class and when it came to architectural work, he was actually having really good grades. He was mathematics and physics were his worst subjects. You could say that his language talent helped him a lot. He was fluent after a very short while, and his classmates forgot that he was not American. And then I think he just started to get into this American mood, and he felt like an American, and he started to appreciate what differed the American mood from the Swedish mood.
So in a sense, it did set him up to be the perfect person
Americans
to go to.
I'm very convinced that the years in Ann Arbor were decisive for him. He got that optimism and that drive that he was impressed by in America, that he came home with a lot of that, actually.
Ingrid, what lessons do you believe could be applied from Raoul Wallenberg's life that could be very important to remember in 2013?
I think that confronted with the ultimate evil, it's not enough with arguing. It's not enough with beautiful words. You need action. He was extremely result-oriented. He was not a speaker. He didn't go onto podiums and things like that. He acted and never lost his optimism, where everyone else said that this is impossible. You cannot do this. You cannot, in the middle of this anarchy of the Arrow Crossers in the end of 1944, he built up a Swedish hospital in 2 or 3 days. And everybody said it's impossible to get medical equipment. But he managed. He managed with everything. He had a lot of fantasy and creativity. So I think the action-oriented answer to ultimate evil is...
I find myself thinking of the closing scenes of Steven Spielberg's movie Schindler's List, when you see the descendants of the Schindler Jews, and you realize that of that core group, the impact it's made on the world, and one can only begin to imagine of the tens of thousands of lives that he saved in 1944 and into 45. Absolutely remarkable. The University of Michigan exhibition, to me, there's no other choice. Raoul Wallenberg, 1912 to 2012. It begins today. Ingrid will be speaking this afternoon at the Michigan Union, and it will run until March 1st at the Michigan Union. We've put a link on our website at michiganradio.org so you can get all the details of this exhibition. Ingrid Carlberg, when will the translation of your book be available here in the U.S.?
I don't know yet, but we're working on it. It's quite thick, you know.
So it is.
690 pages. So.
Well, once it comes out, I'm sure it'll be a stunning read, and I'm sure many people will want to share in that. But in the meantime, we have the U of M exhibition in order to give people a better understanding of this remarkable man. Thank you so much for joining us today.